This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Now, around the world, operating landscapes have changed dramatically as countries and companies grapple with the impact of COVID-19. And for Indonesia, the economic hit has indeed been severe as the country fell into recession in the third quarter for the first time since the Asian financial crisis. So this morning, we're speaking with Gita Wirjawan, chairman of Indonesia's Ancora Group, for a snapshot of private equity as well as the economic environment in Indonesia. He also served as the country's Minister of International Trade from 2011 to 2014. Gita, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Lynn. Happy to be here.
So Ancora Group has interests in private equity investing, natural resources, real estate, sports, and as well as music. So it's quite a diverse company. Tell us why you chose to set this up in the first place.
It was actually founded in the mid part of 2008, and the group is basically branched out into private equity activities and non-private equity activities. Whereas the private equity has been predominantly, been busy with at the early stage with natural resources, but as of late more with respect to real estate. Whereas the non-private equity parts of the group we've been quite engaged in conversations on, tech, but also on content creation and education, and of course hospitality. So it's quite a number of things that we're trying to do. But we're as we speak right now with COVID-19 and all that, we're trying to focus on a smaller number of activities. I think from a private equity standpoint, the reason why we're sort of like going heavier on real estate. The parts of real estate that we're focused on are actually those that cater more to the middle and low segments of the society, which I believe are more robust than the middle, upper and upper segments of the society. And we've seen, very robust trajectory in the last 8 or 9 months. In terms of demand for, smaller housing facilities in not only in the outskirts of Jakarta, but also in the secondary cities of Indonesia. So I think the long view with respect to, middle and low segments of the society in terms of housing, I think would be quite sanguine, at minimum. And this is also on the back of the fact that, between 15 to 20 million, heads of households in the country still do not have housing. So I'm quite positive about this going forward.
So Ancora Capital also has two funds. I'm wondering, have you closed your second fund yet? And how many investments has Ancora been able to make out of it?
Well, we've made only three investments, and we're at the tail of the investment period. And as of late, we're actually more active with respect to the second fund, which is predominantly real estate focused. And that's what I was earlier talking about.
Right. What kind of a hurdle rate do you look for? What kind of a time horizon are you looking at? 5 to 10 years, perhaps?
In countries like Indonesia, where the risk premium, tends to be a little bit higher than countries like Malaysia, which are, better rated. The hurdle rate, happens to be slightly higher than that in countries like Malaysia. The typical hurdle rates for, PEs in Indonesia would be between 10 to 12%, but some are actually at below 10%. But it really depends on the sectors that you're basically focused on. I would think that, with respect to some of the other theses, such as tech and all that, I think the hurdle rates requirements are a little bit different.
So you've described your fund's investment strategy before this as Sharia-like rather than Sharia-compliant. What does that also mean in terms of framing an investment decision for Ancora?
Well, that was actually the first fund, which has actually ended. Whereas the second fund, which is pre-existing and still ongoing as we speak, it's not necessarily Sharia compliant or Sharia-like. But what we did, with respect to the first fund, was to basically make sure that, you know, they're actually Sharia compliant. And it could be in the context of, a couple of the investments that we did, which were actually natural resource, capabilities. But the way the governance and the way the structuring of the deals were in compliance with the requirements of Sharia.
There's also been a stated focus, I don't know whether that this extends to your second fund as well, on what Ancora Capital defined as middle market players, so companies with an enterprise value of under $100 million. Has it been easy to find companies that fit your criteria? Perhaps you could also give us some insight into kind of how robust the private equity landscape is in Indonesia.
Well, I mean, finding companies that are below $100 million in terms of top line would be quite easy in places like Indonesia, given the fact that, there's about 65 million middle or small medium entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So it's actually the more robust segment, whereas finding anything above $100 million, it would be a lot more finite. But then you've got to basically peel the onion, right, and try to find out which sectors are actually more appealing than others. I do see, the COVID-19 having affected a number of the verticals within that, broad dimension of companies with $100 million or less. And I think going forward, there's going to be further streamlining, as we speak, by way of the deceleration of aggregate demand globally and regionally and locally, and by way of the slowing down of production and productivity in most countries, if not many, people tend to want to virtualize as opposed to physicalize. And this, I think, has impacted those that have shown ability to adapt. So the PEs that have, luckily invested in companies that have been able to show, that adaptive capacity, I think are going to do all right. Whereas those that, have done otherwise will probably not do as all right.
Ancora is also, of course, one of four local established players in Indonesia in the private equity landscape. I mean, other names include Saratoga Investor Masdaya, North Star Equity Partners. So, how do you stack up not just to local competition? Because you also have foreign PE firms who are interested in the Indonesian landscape, particularly since, as you illustrated, there is quite a pool to choose from. I mean, your local competitor, North Star, manages nearly $2 billion in assets under management. What kind of a quantum of funds does Ancora Capital manage?
Well, I mean, Saratoga and North Star are completely on a different planet. They're a lot bigger than we are. And we never really aspired to be, a big player. That makes it actually easier to maneuver, because we're maneuvering in probably segments or niches that, these guys are probably not going to be looking at. They've been playing in, I think, a wider spectrum of quantum. They've taken deals, in sizes that we would have taken, but we would never take, many of the quantum that they have done over the years, given the fact that, they're managing a lot bigger size than we are. So that I think is a very clear differentiation or distinction between us and those two other players. Now, with respect to the international PE firms, I do see a much more collaborative effort amongst both the local big and the foreign big PE firms. And that, I think, has been reflected in some of the collaborative efforts in some of the, more popular names that they've invested in. So I don't see, the competition intensifying going forward between the local big private equity firms and the foreign big private equity firms, given the fact that, doing business in Indonesia is not relatively not that easy. So it's much more of a who you know model as opposed to a what you know model. So I think foreign private equity firms have come to the recognition that they've got to figure out a way to collaborate if and when possible.
And I'd like to come back to Indonesia's business landscape in a second. But just before that, Ancora mainly tends to focus on the Indonesian market itself, right? So are you planning to look overseas at all?
No, we're not. We're exclusively domestic. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to, you know, look at, you know, real estate more than ever, particularly the middle and low segments. We're talking about building and developing and selling affordable housing, you know, propositions.
I'm speaking with Gita Wirjawan, former Indonesian Minister of International Trade and Chairman of Indonesia's Ancora Group. Up next, a closer look at how Indonesia's business landscape has developed and its economy in the wake of COVID-19. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Gita Wirjawan, Chairman of Indonesia's Ancora Group and former Minister of International Trade. Now, Gita, earlier we were talking a bit about the private equity landscape in Indonesia. Now I would like to broaden that conversation to talk about Indonesia's business landscape as a whole. The most recent Corruption Perceptions Index ranked Indonesia at 85th in the world. There has been a slow but steady improvement, it seems, in how people perceive Indonesia and its operating landscape. But how would you categorize the ease of doing business in Indonesia at present point, as well as its transition over the period that you've been active there?
It's gotten a lot better, to be quite honest. We were, you know, ranked, I think, 120 to 130th. Years ago, you know, in the ease of doing business that would have been published by the World Bank. Now we're, I think, in the 70s. You know, it was still a long way to go to keep up with the Malaysias of the world and particularly the Singapores of the world. But, you know, when you're making an investment to build, let's say, a factory or a manufacturing capability, you know, you're not taking a 6 month view, right? You're taking a 20-year view. Of a particular destination or country. And whether or not you want to build something in Indonesia depends on where you see Indonesia going in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. I think, you know, I'm a complete believer of the fact that, you know, given the directionality that we've gone through in the last 5, 10, 15 years, there's no reason for us not to be able to maintain that directionality in the next 10, 20 to 30 years. And at the end of the day, it's all about scale, right? I mean, Malaysia has, what, 23 to 25 million people? Mm-hmm. Indonesia has, what, 270 million people? I mean, if you're somebody in a multinational company with the power and ability to make decisions to move capital, you're more than likely to move that capital to a destination that has scale. Then you probably try to attach to that thesis the idea of whether or not that country of scale or destination of scale, you know, will be spending enough money on education. And we legislated a few years ago a law that would basically require our spending 20% of our budget on education. And that's 20% is a lot higher than what Malaysia's government is allocating for mm-hmm. educational purposes. So going back to, you know, the view taking with respect to the next 10 to 20 years, I'm pretty optimistic about the ability of Indonesia and the Indonesian government to make sure that the directionality is going to be maintained in a positive direction. So I think we're going to look a lot better 10 to 20 years from today in terms of the ease of doing business, in terms of, you know, the corruption, you know, index, in terms of any metric that would be of consideration by any person of decision-making capabilities in a multinational setting.
But this is talking a little bit further into the future, right? So 10 and 20 years. But right now, Indonesia, it's charted its second straight quarter of economic contraction. So falling into a recession for the first time in 20 years. So, you know, how is Indonesia, you know, how would you propose that Indonesia rethink its strategic focus and its position right now to try and come back from the blow that has been dealt it by COVID-19?
Yeah, but, you know, we have to think in relative terms and absolute terms, right? Mm-hmm. Relative to what Malaysia is going through, relative to what Singapore is going through, relative to what the Philippines is going through, I think we're looking pretty okay, right? We can talk about facts and figures. But in terms of rethinking, look, the first principles of Indonesia's economy is that, it is hinging on domestic consumptive propensity, which makes up about 55 to 60% of the GDP,
mm-hmm.
right? Then you take a 6 month view or you take a 30-year view. Given our demographic profile, given our reproductive profile, we're going to be able to maintain the youth or youthfulness of our population for the next 20 to 30 years. And that makes us continuously consumptive. So I would bet a dollar or a donut that, 10 to 20 years from today, our domestic consumptive propensity will still make up 55 to 60% of the GDP. So that, I think, does not require too much of a rethink in terms of, where our GDP is going to be moving in the next 6 months or in the next 10 to 20 years. Now, the rethink, I think, would be required with respect to the remaining 40% of our GDP or economic pie. That relates to basically the extent to which we want to vertically integrate our manufacturing capabilities. That basically relates to the extent to which, we're going to be able to collect taxes. Our tax ratio stands at about 10.5 to 11% of our GDP. Vis-a-vis Malaysia is at 14% and the other ASEAN countries at between 13 to 15%. So if we could move the needle from 11% to, let's say, 20% in the next 10 to 20 years, our government budget is going to be a lot higher relatively and absolutely than what it is today, so that we can actually spend more money on things that matter, particularly the soft infrastructure and the hard infrastructure. And that will, I think, dovetail into our ability to basically increase our marginal productivity, which stands at about $24,000 vis-a-vis Malaysia, $55,000 vis-a-vis, Singapore is $150,000, $160,000. So I think the next 10 to 20 years, we plow, more and more money into education and the hard infrastructure for purposes of building connectivity. I think we're going to be able to basically augment and enrich the remaining 40% of the economic pie. So that actually is a rethink with respect to the remaining 40%, but it's not a pretty significant rethink. Whereas other countries in Southeast Asia, which unfortunately or fortunately do not have as much scale as we do, I think they will require a much bigger rethink.
So what are your thoughts on the new omnibus law that President Joko Widodo has just pushed through? I mean, it sparked a lot of unrest within the country itself, but its aim was ultimately to boost jobs and investments. Do you think it will achieve what it was set out to do and perhaps take the first steps towards the rethink that you were outlining?
It's actually an incremental approach of rethinking, right? Our economic blueprint. Omnibus law was designed to basically improve the investment climate. And the simplification would have been done by way of, anybody's not having to go through multi-stages of approval processes, right? Be it at the central, federal, or at the regional levels. And number two, it's, with respect to some of the simplification of the sectors so that you actually don't have to get too many complications. One concrete example would be the extension of the leasehold of your land, which would have been only, for an additional 20 to 30 years, but now it's going to be 80 to 90 years. That, in a way, allows any business person to make, more certain or more confident predictions about where things are going to be in the next 50 to 80 to 90 years, as opposed to only the next 20 to 30 years. I think the nobility of the rethink is pretty solid. The way it was socialized probably could have been better, right? And that, I think, was probably part of why, you might have seen on TV or in the news about what might have happened in Indonesia. But I do believe that it's going to improve upon the pre-existing narrative. But as much as we could improve upon the pre-existing narrative, we're also going to need a better narrator, right? As good a narrative as you can get, if you don't have a good narrator, that narrative is not going to get heard in Nebraska.
So do you think that there will be the potential in the future for us to see Indonesia to take a more leadership position on a regional basis? Because Indonesia does have many things going for it, some of which you've outlined. So a strong domestic consumer base, natural resources. But thus far, from an ASEAN perspective as well, we've seen Indonesia seemingly take a much more inward-looking perspective rather than operating on a wider regional scale. So what's stopping Indonesia from occupying that more forward-leading position in ASEAN?
Look, I mean, it's ASEAN has been around since, what, 1967? I actually would like to take it back to 2,000 years ago. And ASEAN has been existing as a pretty peaceful and stable region, right, with relatively very, very little, if not low, bloodshed as compared to the kind of bloodshed we might have seen in the First World War or the Second World War, which would have taken place with an interval of only 30 to 35 years. What, 120, 130 million people dead? And if we go back to the 17th century, the Napoleonic periods, the Byzantine periods in Europe and pre-Byzantine, we're talking about many hundreds of millions of deaths vis-a-vis what we have encountered in the last 2,000 years. So to me, you know, as much as, you know, ASEAN has been graced by Buddhism for 400 years, Hinduism for 600 years, colonialism, Islam, Christianity, independence, democratization, and all that good stuff, we've been a much more peaceful and stable region. So I do not, you know, try to take into account what is episodic today in the context of what we would have gone through in the last 2,000 years. I think it's we got to be thankful that Southeast Asia has remained as peaceful and stable as it is. It does not have to be reflected in some sort of a dominant type of positioning by any leadership within a country. I think we've got to make sure that we stay cohesive and collective. Now, how is it going to go, you know, in the future? I foresee a future where once, you know, Indonesia gets its rethink, you know, in place, economically speaking, politically speaking, geopolitically speaking, it's only going to be natural that the leadership position that you might have been alluding to would be a lot more visible. But I think it's important to recognize that despite the fact that from a perception, you know, standpoint, we may not be as dominant as needed, I think we've stuck together pretty cohesively, and that's a good thing.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show to speak to us this morning, Gita. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Gita Wirjawan, chairman of Indonesia's Ancora Group. Gita will be speaking at the Leadership Energy Asia Summit 2020, taking place virtually starting today. Visit asb.edu.my/LESA2020 for more information. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.